Address to Young Men on the Right Use of Greek Literature by St. Basil the Great. Part 2. Now, as I have heard from one skillful in interpreting the mind of a poet, all the poetry of Homer is a praise of virtue, and with him all that is not merely accessory tends to this end. There is a notable instance of this where Homer first made the princess reverence the leader of the Cephalonians, though he appeared naked, shipwrecked, and alone, and then made Odysseus, as completely lack embarrassment, though seen naked and alone, since virtue served him as a garment. And next he made Odysseus so much esteemed by the other Phaeacians, that, abandoning the luxury in which they lived, all admired and emulated him, and there was not one of them who longed for anything else except to be Odysseus, even to the enduring of shipwreck. The interpreter of the poetic mind argued that in this episode Homer very plainly says, "Be virtue your concern, O man, which both swims to shore with the shipwrecked man, and makes him, when he comes naked to the strand, be more honored than the prosperous Phaeacians." And indeed, this is the truth, for other possessions belong to the owner no more than to another. And as when men are dicing, fall now to this one, now to that. But virtue is the only possession that is sure, and that remains with us whether living or dead. Wherefore it seems to me that Solon had the rich in mind when he said, "We will not exchange our virtue for their gold, for virtue is an everlasting possession, while riches are ever-changing owners." Similarly, Theognis said that the god, whatever he might mean by the god, inclines the balances for men, now this way, now that, giving to some riches and to others poverty. Also Prodicus, the sophist of Chaos, whose opinion we must respect, for he is a man not to be slighted, somewhere in his writings expressed similar ideas about virtue and vice. I do not remember the exact words, but as far as I recollect the sentiment, in plain prose it ran somewhat as follows. While Hercules was yet a youth, being about your age, as he was debating which path he should choose, the one leading through toil to virtue, or its easier alternate, two women appeared before him, who proved to be virtue and vice. Though they said not a word, the difference between them was at once apparent from their mien. The one had arranged herself to please the eye, while she exhaled charms, and a multitude of delights swarmed in her train. With such a display, and promising still more, she sought to allure Hercules to her side. The other, wasted and squalid, looked fixedly at him, and bespoke quite another thing, for she promised nothing easy or engaging, but rather infinite toils and hardships, and perils in every land and on every sea. As a reward for these trials, he was to become a god, so our author has it. The latter, Hercules, at length followed. Almost all who have written upon the subject of wisdom have more or less, in proportion to their several abilities, extolled virtue in their writings. Such men must one obey, and must try to realize their words in his life. For he who, by his works, exemplifies the wisdom which, with others, is a matter of theory alone, breathes. All others flutter about like shadows. I think it is as if a painter should represent some marvel of manly beauty, and the subject should actually be such a man as the artist pictures on the canvas. To praise virtue in public with brilliant words and with long drawn-out speeches, while in private preferring pleasures to temperance and self-interest to justice, finds an analogy on the stage. For the players frequently appear as kings and rulers, though they are neither, nor perhaps even genuinely free men. A musician would hardly put up with a lyre which was out of tune, nor a choragus with a chorus not singing in perfect harmony. But every man is divided against himself, who does not make his life conform to his words, but who says with Euripides, "The mouth indeed hath sworn, but the heart knows no oath." Such a man will seek the appearance of virtue rather than the reality. But to seem to be good when one is not so is, if we are to respect the opinion of Plato at all, the very height of injustice. After this wise, then, are we to receive those words from the pagan authors which contain suggestions of the virtues. But since also the renowned deeds of the men of old either are preserved for us by tradition or are cherished in the pages of poet or historian, we must not fail to profit by them. A fellow of the street rabble once kept taunting Pericles, but he, meanwhile, gave no heed, and they held out all day, the fellow deluging him with reproaches, but he, for his part, not caring. Then, when it was evening and dusk, and the fellow still clung to him, Pericles escorted him with a light, in order that he might not fail in the practice of philosophy. Again, a man in a passion threatened and vowed death to Euclid of Megara, but he in turn vowed that the man should surely be appeased and cease from his hostility toward him. How invaluable it is to have such examples in mind when a man is seized with anger! On the other hand, one must altogether ignore the tragedy which says in so many words, "Anger arms the hand against the enemy." For it is much better not to give way to anger at all. But if such restraint is not easy, we shall at least curb our anger by reflection, so as not to give it too much rein. But let us bring our discussion back again to the examples of noble deeds. A certain man once kept striking Socrates, the son of Sophroniscus, in the face. Yet he did not resent it, but allowed full play to the ruffian's anger, so that his face was swollen and bruised from the blows. Then, when he stopped striking him, Socrates did nothing more than to write on his forehead, as an artisan on a statue, "Who did it?" and thus took out his revenge. Since these examples almost coincide with our teachings, I hold that such men are worthy of emulation. For this conduct of Socrates is akin to the precept that to him who smites you upon the one cheek, you shall turn the other also. Thus much may you be avenged. The conduct of Pericles and of Euclid also conforms to the precept, "Submit to those who persecute you, and endure their wrath with meekness." And to the other, "Pray for your enemies, and curse them not." One who has been instructed in the pagan examples will no longer hold the Christian precepts impracticable. But I will not overlook the conduct of Alexander, who on taking captive the daughters of Darius, who were reputed to be of surpassing beauty, would not even look at them, for he deemed it unworthy of one who was a conqueror of men to be a slave to women. This is of a piece with the statement that he who looks upon a woman to lust after her, even though he does not commit the act of adultery, is not free from its guilt, since he has entertained impure thoughts. It is hard to believe that the action of Cleinias, one of the disciples of Pythagoras, was in accidental conformity to our teaching, and not designed imitation of them. What then was this act of his? By taking an oath, he could have avoided a fine of 3 talents. Yet, rather than do so, he paid the fine, even though he could have sworn truthfully. I am inclined to think that he had heard of the precept which forbids us to swear. But let us return to the same thought with which we started, namely, that we should not accept everything without discrimination, but only what is useful. For it would be shameful should we reject injurious foods, yet should take no thought about the studies which nourish our souls, but as a torrent should sweep along all that came near our path and appropriate it. If the helmsman does not blindly abandon his ship to the winds, but guides it toward the anchorage, if the archer shoots at his mark, if also the metal worker or the carpenter seeks to produce the objects for which his craft exists, would there be rhyme or reason in our being outclassed by these men, mere artisans as they are, in quick appreciation of our interests? For is there not some end in the artisan's work? Is there not a goal in human life, which the one who would not wholly resemble unreasoning animals must keep before him in all his words and deeds? If there were no intelligence sitting at the tiller of our souls, like boats without ballast, we should be borne hither and thither through life, without plan or purpose. An analogy may be found in the athletic contests, or, if you will, in the musical contests, for the contestants prepare themselves by a preliminary training for those events in which wreaths of victory are offered. And no one, by training for wrestling or for the pancratium, would get ready to play the lyre or the flute. At least, Polydamas would not, for before the Olympic games he was wont to bring the rushing chariot to a halt, and thus hardened himself. Then Milo could not be thrust from his smeared shield, but, shoved as he was, clung to it as firmly as statues soldered by lead. In a word, by their training they prepared themselves for the contests. If they had meddled with the heirs of Marsyas or of Olympus, the Phrygians, abandoning dust and exercise, would they have won ready laurels or crowns? Or would they have escaped being laughed at for their bodily incapacity? On the other hand, certainly Timotheus the musician did not spend his time in the schools for wrestling, for then it would not have been his to excel all in music. He who was so skilled in his art that at his pleasure he could arouse the passions of men by his harsh and vehement strains, and then, by gentle ones, quiet and soothe them. By this art, when once he played Phrygian airs on the flute to Alexander, he is said to have incited the general to arms in the midst of feasting, and then, by milder music, to have restored him to his carousing friends. Such power to compass one's end, either in music or in athletic contests, is developed by practice. I have called to mind the wreaths and the fighters. These men endure hardships beyond number. They use every means to increase their strength. They sweat ceaselessly at their training. They accept many blows from the master. They adopt the mode of life which he prescribes, though it is most unpleasant. And, in a word, they so rule all their conduct that their whole life before the contest is preparatory to it. Then they strip themselves for the arena and endure all and risk all to receive the crown of olive, or of parsley, or some other branch, and to be announced by the herald as victor. Will it then be possible for us, to whom are held out rewards so wondrous in number and in splendor that tongue cannot recount them, while we are fast asleep and leading carefree lives, to make these our own by half-hearted efforts? Surely, were an idle life a very commendable thing, Sardanapalus would take the first prize, or Marketes, if you will, whom Homer, if indeed the poem is by Homer, put down as neither a farmer, nor a vine-dresser, nor anything else that is useful. Is there not rather truth in the maxim of Pittacus, which says, "It is hard to be good"? For after we have actually endured many hardships, we shall scarcely gain those blessings to which, as said above, nothing in human experience is comparable. Therefore, we must not be light-minded, nor exchange our immortal hopes for momentary idleness, lest reproaches come upon us and judgment befall us. Not, forsooth, here among men, although judgment here is no easy thing for the man of sense to bear, but at the bar of justice, be that under the earth or wherever else it may happen to be. While he who unintentionally violates his obligations perchance receives some pardon from God, he who designedly chooses a life of wickedness doubtless has a far greater punishment to endure. What then are we to do? Perchance someone may ask. What else than to care for the soul, never leaving an idle moment for other things? Accordingly, we ought not to serve the body any more than is absolutely necessary, but we ought to do our best for the soul, releasing it from the bondage of fellowship with the bodily appetites. At the same time, we ought to make the body superior to passion. We must provide it with the necessary food, to be sure, but not with delicacies, as those do who seek everywhere for waiters and cooks, and scour both earth and sea like those bringing tribute to some stern tyrant. This is a despicable business, in which are endured things as unbearable as the torments of hell, where wool is combed into the fire, or water is drawn into a sieve and poured into a perforated jar, and where work is never done. Then, to spend more time than is necessary on one's hair and clothes is, in the words of Diogenes, the part of the unfortunate or of the sinful. For what difference does it make to a sensible man whether he is clad in a robe of state or in an inexpensive garment, so long as he is protected from heat and cold? Likewise, in other matters, we must be governed by necessity, and only give so much care to the body as is beneficial to the soul. For to one who is really a man, it is no less a disgrace to be a fop or a pamperer of the body than to be the victim of any other base passion. Indeed, to be very zealous in making the body appear very beautiful is not the mark of a man who knows himself, or who feels the force of the wise maxim, "Not that which is seen is the man." For it requires a higher faculty for any one of us, whoever he may be, to know himself. Now it is harder for the man who is not pure in heart to gain this knowledge than for a blear-eyed person to look upon the sun. To speak generally, and so far as your needs demand, purity of soul embraces these things: to scorn sensual pleasures, to refuse to feast the eyes on the senseless antics of buffoons, or on bodies which goad one to passion, and to close one's ears to songs which corrupt the mind. For passions which are the offspring of servility and baseness are produced by this kind of music. On the other hand, we must employ that class of music which is better in itself and which leads to better things, which David, the sacred psalmist, is said to have used to assuage the madness of the king. Also, tradition has it that when Pythagoras happened upon some drunken revelers, he commanded the flute player who led the merrymaking to change the tune and play a Doric air, and that the chant so sobered them that they threw down their wreaths and shamefacedly returned home. Others, at the sound of the flute, rave like Corybantes and Bacchantes. Even so great a difference does it make whether one lends his ear to healthy or to vicious music. Therefore, you ought to have still less to do with the music of such influence than with other infamous things. Then, I am ashamed to forbid you to load the air with all kinds of sweet-smelling perfumes or to smear yourselves with ointment. Again, what further argument is needed against seeking the gratification of one's appetite than that it compels those who pursue it, like animals, to make of their bellies a god? In a word, he who would not bury himself in the mire of sensuality must deem the whole body of little worth, or must, as Plato puts it, pay only so much heed to the body as is an aid to wisdom. Or, as Paul admonishes somewhere in a similar passage, let no one make provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof. Wherein is there any difference between those who take pains that the body shall be perfect, but ignore the soul, for the use of which it is designed, and those who are scrupulous about their tools, but neglectful of their trade? On the contrary, one ought to discipline the flesh and hold it under, as a fierce animal is controlled, and to quiet, by the lash of reason, the unrest which it engenders in the soul, and not, by giving full rein to pleasure, to disregard the mind, as a charioteer is run away with by unmanageable and frenzied horses. So let us bear in mind the remark of Pythagoras, who, upon learning that one of his followers was growing very fleshy from gymnastics and hearty eating, said to him, "Will you not stop making your imprisonment harder for yourself?" Then it is said that, since Plato foresaw the dangerous influence of the body, he chose an unhealthy part of Athens for his academy, in order to remove excessive bodily comfort, as one prunes the rank shoots of the vines. Indeed, I have even heard physicians say that overhealthiness is dangerous. Since then, this exaggerated care of the body is harmful to the body itself, and a hindrance to the soul, it is sheer madness to be a slave to the body and serve it. End of part 2.